The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea, for those of you who I've not met before. It's nice to be here this evening. So tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about why we engage in our practice and about how the practice supports us. I think most of us, or many of us at least, come to our practice because of a sense of there's something not quite right in our lives. We're interested in exploring other ways of being, other ways of meeting, exploring our lives. You know, that's why I came to the practice. I felt like I'd kind of hit bottom at one point and you know, just kind of felt like there's got to be a different way to live my life here. And so I think many of us have a similar kind of question that we're exploring. And I'd like to explore a little bit about how the practices that we work with here, the practices of mindfulness, of investigation, of concentration, support our coming to understand our lives. How do these practices actually do that? The Buddha also came to this search because of this question of suffering. I mean, he really engaged or embarked on his path because he wanted to understand this, what he saw as the problem of the human condition. He wasn't just exploring it for himself alone. My understanding is that he really was motivated out of compassion for everyone that he saw that was suffering. It's kind of like, what is this suffering that we're experiencing? How does this happen? Why do we, you know, try so hard to be happy and end up suffering? And so this was the question he was exploring, he was trying to answer. And in his practice, over the course of the 6 years or so of his practice, before he became awakened, before he became enlightened, he began to understand that this suffering, this Pali word for suffering, dukkha, often translated as suffering, but means broader, has a broader meaning than that. It conveys a sense of unease, dissatisfaction, of stress, of unreliability, that just, you know, there's this sense that our lives aren't quite running the way we'd like them to be running. And so in the exploration of this, what he found in his own experience is that what we call suffering, this offness that we feel, that things aren't quite right, that there's something off in our lives, whether we call it suffering or stress or dis-ease or dissatisfaction, that is caused not by what's happening around us. Now, what's happening around us is contributing to that feeling, but the feeling of offness is created by a reaction to those experiences. It's created by our own minds. So he discovered in his own experience that this problem of suffering, this problem of dissatisfaction that we all feel, this sense of dissatisfaction with our lives, that this sense of dissatisfaction comes not from our experience itself, but rather our relationship to the experience. We somehow always want it to be different than it is, or we want to hold on to our experience and find that it's endlessly changing, or we're finding that what is happening in the world is not the way we'd like it, and we'd like to try to change it, manipulate it, and fix it so that it's to our liking. And so he said that this problem of suffering is something that can be addressed in our own minds. You know, this is actually really good news, because if it was something that was out in the world that was creating our sense of dissatisfaction, of stress, of unease, it would be a hopeless case. It would be a hopeless situation. But because it's in our own minds, it's our own mind's relationship, there is hope. There's a possibility that we can learn how to relate to our experience in a way that brings us a sense of ease, of peace. So this is essentially what the Buddha woke up to, this recognition of this suffering being, this stress, this dissatisfaction being created by essentially wanting things to be other than they are. And he discovered also a path leading to the ending of that dissatisfaction, of that stress, of that suffering. And after he became awakened, he kind of looked out on the world. And what he saw when he, you know, thought about how people were engaging in their lives was that people were trying really hard to be happy, trying really hard to find a way to satisfaction. But what they were doing was actually the exact opposite thing that then would lead to their true happiness. And so out of compassion for all of us, he began to teach a set of practices, a set of tools that would help us to kind of reorient our perspective on the world. Essentially, he saw that we kind of have a skewed perspective on what will make us happy, and that there's a way we can reorient our perspective, and through that reorientation, learn how to meet our experience with ease, with peace, with balance of mind, so that we're not suffering, we're not reacting. So this path that the Buddha taught, the set of practices, the set of tools that the Buddha taught, is the Eightfold Path. So it's essentially this Eightfold Path, which is the statement of the Four Noble Truths that we need to, of the Fourth Noble Truth, that we need to engage with practices that will support our understanding of suffering, which is the First Noble Truth, which will lead us to letting go of the cause of suffering, this wanting things to be other than they are, which is the Second Noble Truth, which will then lead us to realize the possibility for freedom from that suffering, that dissatisfaction. So the path that the Buddha offered is the set of tools that he gave to us to help us reorient our perspective. And it's not just a reorienting of the perspective, it's actually practices that we engage with. And these are the practices that we work with here at this center. So I'll just briefly, very briefly, go over the Eightfold Path, because that's not the main topic of my talk here, but I want to give you the framework of the Eightfold Path so that we can explore together how that Eightfold Path supports us in becoming free, in becoming free from this suffering. So the Eightfold Path has basically three sections to it. There's a section of wisdom, of how we orient, essentially the wisdom of how we orient our minds, this shift of perspective I was talking about. So the wisdom component of the Eightfold Path is comprised of two aspects, wise understanding and wise intention. And this shift of perspective that the Buddha pointed to is essentially looking at our experience through this framework of the Four Noble Truths, really seeing, understanding how suffering comes to be, that it is not something that's out there, that it is created, caused by our reaction to what's out there. So that kind of shift of perspective, that's really the key, crucial shift of perspective that we need to start with. This wisdom that the suffering that we are experiences is created, caused by some way that we're reacting to our experience. So that at the beginning, that's a kind of an intellectual understanding. It's not something that we know deep in our bones, but perhaps some of us have heard that. And if we're in a place, like I said, I was in a place of feeling like I'd kind of hit bottom, and I heard some of these teachings, and it's kind of like, well, you know, I don't know. I don't quite understand how this, you know, suffering is created in my own mind, but maybe I'll give these things a try, you know, maybe I'll explore this. So that the exploration of hearing the teachings when you're in a particularly open place of being receptive might lead you to then start to engage in the teachings. So this is where we move from just study or listening to the teachings to actually beginning to act on the teachings. So when we meet a teaching, when we meet an explanation that resonates with us, we may decide, yeah, that sounds like something I'd like to explore. So then our intentions start to become in line with those teachings. And in this, this is the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, right, wise intention. It's essentially the intentions that are in line with this understanding about how suffering is created, and that we begin to explore our experience from that perspective, essentially willing to engage in these teachings of the Eightfold Path. So the wise understanding and wise intention at the beginning of our practice are a reorientation of our minds and a willingness to engage in some teachings, in some practices, in some tools, willingness to engage in some actions, behaviors that the Buddha suggests would be helpful for us. So that's the wisdom aspect of the path. So the understanding and the intention towards engaging begins to open us up to being willing to follow some of these practices. The next aspect of the Eightfold Path is what we could call the ethical component of the Eightfold Path. These are teachings, suggestions of how to behave in the world in an ethical way, essentially in a non-harming way, so that we orient our outward actions towards non-harming, non-harming of ourself, non-harming of others. So the three aspects of the Eightfold Path in this section are wise speech, wise understanding, and wise livelihood. And really this, I'm not going to go into detail about these, but it really is the orientation around creating harmony in our lives, creating harmony in the world, that we are not contributing to the suffering of ourselves or others through our behaviors, through our speech, through our actions, through the work that we do. We are committed to harmonizing our relationships in the world with a people, with other people, with ourselves. So living peacefully with a heart that inclines towards non-harming. So this second aspect of the Eightfold Path is about non-harming. So these are specific practices we engage with. We engage with trying to behave outwardly in ways that don't create stress, suffering, or harm for ourselves or others. And the third aspect of the Eightfold Path is what could be called mental development, that we, having engaged with our outer behavior in a non-harming way, we begin to see that there's stuff going on in our minds that creates internal strife, internal struggle. So even as we clean up our relationships in the world, there's a way that we begin to see that our own minds are creating a kind of a dissonance inside. And so this mental training is designed to address that. The mental training, the three aspects of the Eightfold Path are wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And these three are really kind of the core of our meditation practice. Not only our meditation practice, but a practice that we engage with in daily life. These tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness in particular, are applicable not only sitting on the cushion, but walking around, engaging with our partners, with our children, with our bosses at work, with the way we drive our cars on the freeway. That we begin to engage with mindfulness and effort to observe when we are in a place of aversion and not liking things and wanting that guy to not be cutting me off and blaring on the horn and saying, oh, that's aversion. Actually, that's harming myself to have that reactivity. So we can, you know, be careful and safe in our driving and not have that kind of reactivity coming up. So this is an exploration for us. We explore these teachings of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So wise effort is kind of the effort to stay connected to our experience and to begin to see what's helpful for us in terms of what will lead us away from this suffering, what will lead us away from stress, dissatisfaction. And we begin to let go of, understand those kind of unhelpful aspects of our mental life. And we begin instead to move towards the cultivation of skillful, wholesome qualities of mind. So this mental cultivation, it helps us to settle down our distracted mind, our jumpy mind, the mind that is reactive and always wanting things to be different, wanting to arrange, to fix, to change, wanting to hold on when things are good, and being frustrated, unhappy when they change, feeling like I've done something wrong because it was so good yesterday and now it's all gone. You know, what did I do wrong? As opposed to really just recognizing this is just the way it is. You know, things change. So this mental cultivation, practice of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, begins to bring our minds into some kind of settledness that allows us to start to see how our mental habits work. It allows us to see how our reactivity is created. And, you know, it really is a way that we, through these practices, we begin to really let go of a lot of our kind of personal conditioning, a lot of our personal habits that lead to our own personal suffering. So the effort to stay connected with experience, understanding what's helpful, what's unhelpful. Mindfulness allows us to recognize what the mind is doing in the present moment. And then bringing those two together, effort and mindfulness together, is what creates the conditions for concentration, for the mind to become more stable in our mindfulness. The stability of mind, the stability of mindfulness is really what leads to concentration. And that concentration is what begins to allow us to see truly how our minds are reacting, what's creating those conditions for reactivity. So the Eightfold Path are really a set of practices. They support us in seeing how our minds react. And in that very seeing, our minds start to settle down and let go of some of that reactivity just through seeing how our minds are doing it. It's really kind of magical in a way that when our own minds see, what seems to happen is that our own minds see how they are contributing to our suffering. And then they, in that recognition, we don't want to suffer. Our minds don't want to suffer. I mean, even if you know, there's nobody really here to be choosing this, but just the process of the mind, when the mind recognizes that it's contributing to its own suffering, it starts to let go of that, because inherently we're kind of set up to not want to suffer. When we're not really mindful, we're essentially that level of where the suffering is born is kind of below the level of our ability to see it. So that kind of reactivity of why can't things be the way I want them to be, you know, it's kind of hidden below our radar that's actually the source of our suffering, whereas we misunderstand that, no, it's just if I really got things to be the way I'd want them to be, that would be happiness. And so there's a real kind of fundamental misunderstanding that we have. And when the mind begins to see that misunderstanding really clearly, it starts to let go of those mistaken notions. So this Eightfold Path supports us kind of seeing how our minds react. And it also is understood that it can lead us to the deepest happiness, the deepest peace, freedom from suffering, complete freedom from suffering. This is what the Buddha discovered when he became awakened, his enlightenment. So what is this freedom? How is it described, this freedom, this complete freedom from suffering? It's actually described in a really simple way. It's described as freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from delusion. This is the understanding that these qualities, greed, aversion, and delusion, are kind of the root cause of our suffering. And it is freedom from those very qualities that leads us to enlightenment, complete peace, liberation. So I want to read a couple of texts that the Buddha spoke about this enlightenment. He said, the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This indeed is called Nibbana. Nibbana is the Pali term for enlightenment. Nirvana is the Sanskrit term. And to go on. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed with mind ensnared, one aims at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and one experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and one experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. So a couple pieces I want to highlight about this, especially from this last paragraph. The Buddha describes the kind of state of freedom from suffering as being one of no mental pain and grief. So just, you know, even just kind of imagine for yourself what it might be like to experience no mental pain and grief. No matter what's going on out in the world, no mental pain or grief. That sounds pretty good to me. The other piece that he said is, this is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life. Now, this is something, I mean, I like this, the fact that this enlightenment here is defined as the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. You know, I can kind of envision that possibility in my life, driving down the freeway or talking to my friends. It's not this teaching around enlightenment, awakening, is not something that's separate from our everyday life. It's not something that has to be considered like we somehow, you know, float away on a cloud of light, you know. It's in this very life we can be free. So that's very inspiring to me, that possibility. So since the Eightfold Path, I mean, since the liberation, this understanding of freedom is understood as the freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion, we might ask, how does the Eightfold Path help to lead to their end? How is it that engaging with these practices of ethical conduct and mental cultivation of meditation, how does that help us to come to the end of greed, aversion, and delusion? There's a teaching around greed, aversion, and delusion, and all the kind of states that are associated with them. Greed, aversion, and delusion are kind of understood to be the root causes of all of the mental dissatisfactory, unhappy states that we experience. You know, frustration, anger, irritation, annoyance, greed, excitement, eagerness, avarice, all of the, and delusion, boredom, confusion, all of those states of mind are kind of rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion. And there's a teaching around all of these kind of states. The term, the Pali term is kilesa for these states, kind of just a broad term for all of the kinds of states that create suffering in our lives, kilesa. And the translation for this is defilement, which is kind of an odd term, you know. That doesn't sound like a very nice term, defilement. But these states create suffering, so they're not very friendly states. So there's a teaching around these defilements that they kind of manifest in our lives at three different levels. The obvious way that they manifest is in how we behave. If we are acting out of states motivated by greed, aversion, and delusion, we're behaving in unskillful ways. You know, we're outwardly acting out. So this is the first level, this level of outwardly acting out on these states of mind, these difficult states of mind. The next level down, the next layer of defilement in our is where they come up in our minds, but we have enough kind of presence of mind to not act on them, so that they may create suffering in our own minds, but at least they're not kind of messing up with our relationships and other people in the world. So that's the next level down, this level of where it's coming up in our minds, but we're not acting out on it. The third level, the subtlest level of these defilements, is understood to be something called latent tendencies. Now, this is where they're not coming up in our minds, they're not actively present in our minds, but kind of the underlying tendency in the mind would be, if the conditions came together just right, they would come right up again. I think we all have a sense of this, you know, that we have patterns in our lives, familiar, favorite kinds of patterns of perhaps anger or loneliness or depression or whatever it is. You know, we all have our own favorite difficulties. And there are times when we know that, yeah, you know, that's a pattern for me, but it's not really coming up right now, you know. It's kind of like I've got a breather from that pattern right now. And we can see that we know our minds well enough to know that, you know, if I walked into my boss's office and my boss said this one thing, you know it would come right back up. So that we have a sense of that, you know, they're kind of in that latent form. These tendencies are in that latent form. So kind of, this is the subtlest form of these defilements, is that they don't necessarily have to actively be acting, coming up in our minds, but they're kind of in a quiet, non-activated form in our mind stream. So the three sections of the Eightfold Path directly address these three levels of defilements, these three levels. So the most obvious level of defilement, that where we're acting out, is countered by the practices of ethical conduct, of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. We take the precepts, we engage with a training to refrain from harming, to refrain from killing living beings, to refrain from false speech, to refrain from taking that which is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct. We see that as we make that commitment, it supports our not acting out of those unwholesome mind states. So that aspect of the Eightfold Path kind of supports us, and actually it's kind of the foundation on which the whole path rests, that this ethical conduct allows us to, you know, if we're acting out in unethical ways, you know, there's not much hope that we'll be able to counter the tendencies of our mind that lead to that action. So the ethical conduct of non-harming is a support for us. It's a kind of a refuge for us to help us to be able to not harm, so that we can begin to watch in our own minds what's going on, so that we can start to meet the second level of kilesa, of defilement, where things are coming up in our mind, where greed, aversion, and delusion is coming up in our mind, but the precepts is providing, the precepts and the ethical component of the Eightfold Path is providing the container whereby we're not acting out as much. So then we get to watch our minds. We get to see these tendencies come up in our mind. And this is where the aspect of mental cultivation comes in. So the aspect of wise speech, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration is what we apply when we're noticing these tendencies in our mind. Now, this is a lot of where our practice is, both in daily life and on the cushion. We see difficult things come up in our mind and we just meet it. Okay, can I be mindful of this anger? Can I turn towards the experience of frustration or depression rather than be engaged in, trying to fix or change the environment? Can I just meet that experience? I know you've all heard these instructions from us before. This is the aspect of mental cultivation applied to these difficult tendencies coming up in our mind. So this these practices of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration kind of work in two ways on these difficult states of mind. One of the ways they work on it is just through the mindfulness itself, the willingness to meet our experience. With mindfulness, when we meet a difficult state of mind, when we meet it with that non-judgmental kind of attention, it creates the conditions for that difficulty to begin to unwind. It's counterintuitive. When we first start recognizing or learning about the teaching of mindfulness, we think, well, pay attention to my anger. Won't that just make it worse? But we quickly see that this non-judgmental mindful attention actually allows that to pass through. It allows that state of mind to pass through, and it doesn't kind of amplify it. It doesn't kind of rev it up. It actually allows it to let go. So the tools of effort, mindfulness, and concentration in applying it to looking at these difficult states start to allow them to let go. The other side of it is that as we explore concentration in particular, coming back to our experience, coming back in particular to one experience, perhaps the breath, over and over again, the mind really settles down, and there's a place in our meditation, especially in our sitting meditation, that when we really connect with our breathing for a period of time, what happens is that there's no room for these difficult states of mind to come up. That greed, aversion, and delusion are kind of at bay because the mind is just really connected with what's happening. It's connected with the breath. And there's no room for those states to come up. This is a really, really lovely place to come to in our meditation practice. There's a name that's sometimes associated with this. It's called the bliss of seclusion. That we are secluded from many of these unwholesome states that come up through this practice of applying effort and mindfulness, leading to a kind of a continuity of attention, which then that continuity of attention keeps these difficult states at bay. So it gives us a taste of what it's like to not have these difficult states coming up in our mind. It gives us a kind of a model of what freedom from suffering would be when we taste the experience of those difficulties not coming up for us. But the state of this freedom with respect to concentration, it's a temporary state. When that concentration falls apart, as it does, because it's a constructed experience, that we are bringing our attention over and over to our breath or our hearing or whatever our experience is. We're making a continuous effort to pay attention. When we let go of that, that concentration falls apart and we find these states coming up again. This is not a problem. It's not a mistake. It doesn't mean that you failed. It's just the way it is. So the fact that these states can keep coming up is because they lie latent in our mind stream. What I talked about, those latent tendencies. So they lie latent. The concentration suppresses those latent tendencies from coming up for a period of time. But when that concentration falls apart, they can resurface. The conditions can come together. We walk into a conversation with our partner and they just push that button. They know right where that button is, and the pattern, the difficult states come up again. So those latent tendencies are not addressed by the state of concentration. Those latent tendencies, this third level of defilement, these latent tendencies are addressed by this last aspect of the Eightfold Path, the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. It takes wisdom to uproot those deeply ingrained patterns. And it's not a wisdom that comes from reflecting about or thinking about anything. It's a wisdom that comes through meeting directly our experience. So I'd like to talk about this for just a few moments. So the quality of mind that lies deep at the root of these latent tendencies is ignorance. It's not an ignorance that's just a simple lack of knowledge, which may be what we normally think of as ignorance, but the ignorance that's at the root of those patterns that lie latent, dormant in our mind that come up when we get into conditions, certain conditions. It's a much more active kind of ignorance. It's actually a very insidious kind of ignorance. It's an active misunderstanding that alters how we see things, how we perceive things, how we view things. So there are three basic misunderstandings that lie at the root of our struggles. And these three are that we take what is impermanent to be permanent. We take what is inherently unreliable or unsatisfactory as a source of happiness, as being a source of happiness. And we take what is not self to be self. So these misunderstandings kind of distort how we see the world. When we apply the teachings of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, it's kind of like they create the conditions for us to be able to see a little more clearly that we are misunderstanding in these ways. So as we turn our attention towards our experience with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, we start to see that our experience is just a flow. It's a continual, unending flow of changing experience. We deeply, more deeply connect with this truth that nothing lasts for very long. So this is an insight. Actually, all three of these, that things are actually that there's kind of a everything that we experience has these three basic qualities of basically being impermanent, that it's unreliable as a place where we could be happy, as kind of if we had that experience, that would make us happy. It's unreliable because it's impermanent, and it's not self. They're insights. the recognitions of these are insights. And the practice of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration creates the conditions for us to see these truths, see these insights. So as we practice, it doesn't happen automatically. You know, it tends to happen as the practice gets more continuous. So as the mindfulness gets more continuous and we can really see what's happening in our minds, what's happening in our experience, we deeply see how impermanent things are. In seeing that things are that impermanent, we see that they're completely unreliable. Because things are that impermanent, there's no way that we could even possibly hold on to them to be happy. That's one of the really fundamental misunderstandings that we have. If I could only arrange the world in the way that I like it, then I would be happy. And it's just not possible. We can arrange the world for a split second, and then the law of impermanence takes over and it starts to change. We don't always feel it changing that quickly, but it will change. And that happiness that was dependent on those conditions will fall away. So we see this with more clarity using these tools of effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And we also start to see the most kind of deep misunderstanding we have is around this notion of self. You know, that there is some being here, some abiding entity that is choosing, deciding, acting, doing. And this is it's a misunderstanding of our experience. You know, there is a process going on. What we take to be self, what we assume to be self, is just a process. It's a process of existence. I'll give you an example around this. You know, if you think about how a tree comes into existence, you know, there's a seed. It starts with a seed, and conditions come together or not, that seed gets water, it gets sun, gets light, and it gets turned into a little sprout. And if the conditions are right, it doesn't get mowed over by a lawnmower or eaten by an animal, it grows a little bigger. And over time, it may turn into a tree. You know, a very long process happening to move from that seed to a full tree. Now, there's no entity guiding that process. It is simply a set of conditions of nature. The conditions that come together to, you know, if there's enough sun and water and no lawnmowers around, you know, it may turn into a tree. It's a process by which it turns into a tree, a natural unfolding by which it does that. And in a similar way, we are an unfolding of processes. So these practices offered by the Eightfold Path begin to allow us to see these truths, to begin to really uproot these fundamental misunderstandings that we have. You know, if there, you know, when we see that things are impermanent, we stop trying to hold on. You know, that it's like it doesn't make any sense to hold on or push away. So greed and aversion begin to fall away. As we see that impermanence, we also really deeply recognize trying to hold on will just lead to suffering, will lead to dissatisfaction. And as we see the truth of not self, you know, we have a fear around this teaching of not self. It feels like something threatening in a way. But in my own experience, as I begin to touch into this truth of not self, you know, the experience of not self is not threatening. It's a relief. when we really get that there's no one that we need to defend or protect, that it's just a set of processes, there's no problem. No self, no problem. So these tools offer us this possibility. They offer us the possibility of kind of letting go of our personal difficulties, our personal struggles that come from our own conditioning, and this more deep freedom that comes from really understanding this shift of perspective. So I've gone over by 3 minutes, I apologize. So thank you for your attention.